8:15 having arrived, I'll call the Education Finance Committee to order, and great to see everyone here bright-eyed this morning. Appreciate that. I think we have a quorum. So do we have, which minutes do we have there? Oh, here we go. We've got two sets of minutes, February 6th and February 7th. Has anyone had a chance to look at those minutes? Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Besides bright-eyed, you forgot bushy-tailed. But I'll move to adopt both sets of minutes.
Very good. Representative Hertas moves to approve the February 6th and February 7th, 2013 minutes. Do I hear any discussion? If not, I'm going to call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The minutes are approved. Today we have four bills that deal with the school shift. And as we know, the school shift has been a process used by the governor and the legislature to help balance the budget. And in my experience here, Democratic governors and Republican governors have used the tool, and Democratic legislatures and Republican legislatures have used that tool. And so before we start, I would ask if Ms. Johnson would just give a little bit of a recap on school shifts.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. At the most basic level, a shift is a cash flow delay. It does not increase or decrease the amount of aid and entitlements to schools. Instead, it adjusts the schedule of when we pay school districts in the case of the aid payment shift, or in when we require school districts to recognize levy revenue in the case of a property tax recognition shift. By adjusting the schedule of when we pay schools or require them to recognize tax receipts, we create a one-time budget savings to the state. As you know, this was a key part of the 2011 budget solution. There's a mechanism in statute that states that any positive balances in the general fund for the current biennium are automatically used to repay the shift. Last February, a projected general fund balance triggered repayment of a portion of that aid payment shift, changing the percentage from 60% to 64.3%. The most recent November 2012 forecast triggered further repayment of that aid shift, changing the percentage from 64.3% to 82.5%, where it stands today. At this time, the cost to pay back the remaining aid payment shift is approximately $550 million, and the cost to repay the property tax recognition shift is also about $550 million, for a total of $1.1 billion remaining to be repaid. That's what it, any questions?
Thank you very much, Ms. Johnson. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, with information sent to members last night of January being almost $170 million above, $169.5 or so, and with the previous November forecast, if we had did nothing with that money, how much of the shift would be paid off just with those projected overages, not taking into account any possible future ones through the remaining of this fiscal year?
Ms. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative Quam, I believe that those numbers are going to be reforecast, or they're going to be put out in 2 weeks, I believe. What those figures would be, I don't have any figure of what the most recent January numbers, how that would impact, but it would flow that would be the mechanism that would be in place to have those funds flow to repay the shift.
But Representative Quam, I think you're asking, I mean, if this would happen to materialize, and I think it was 140, and then in November and December another 110 or so. I think it's like, since November forecast, about $250 million and 254. And I think you calculate about $72 million per percentage. So you know, what would that be? Another 3.5%? Is that 82.5%? Possibly 86. But that's, we're going to have to wait till the forecast to find that out. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's true that
when we look at that, that's the revenue forecast, so we don't know what the expenses are as well, right, the expenditures? Okay, thank you.
That, yes, Representative Woodard, that's exactly correct. So there's other calculations that need to go into that final number. Before we get going and before we start hearing the first bill, just there is a fiscal note in your packet from House File 165. That was Representative Slocum's bill. We didn't have a fiscal note for that last meeting. That should be in your packet. Yeah. And then also there are some additional handouts from the governor's budget changes. That is either in your green folder or sleeve, I guess, or if we had your binder, it would we put those right in the binder so you can, there might be some changes there also. My intent is to lay over the four bills that we have for possible inclusion into the omnibus report, omnibus bill. So with that, we have our author, the House File number one, Representative Selzer. Welcome to the committee, your own committee. So would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File number one for possible inclusion into the Omnibus Education Finance Bill. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my bill offers a time certain for payback of the delayed payment shift to our schools, ensuring that the current year aid payment percentage equals 90% in fiscal years 2014 and later. It eliminates the use of gimmicks and excessive shifts around payment of aid to our schools as we move into the future, thus saving school districts future borrowing costs. And Melissa's already gone through the history, which you can find more in detail on the back of your state education funding accounting shifts with the exciting title, Recent Changes in the School Aid Payment Percentage and School Property Tax Recognition Shifts Amounts. So Minnesota, as was mentioned, Minnesota management and budget estimates that to complete paying back the aid payment shift to a 90-10 ratio will cost $546 million in fiscal year 13. And it is time, Mr. Chair and members, to move to provide our schools with predictable and stable funding. It's time to stop the roller coaster of aid payments to our schools, which has led many schools to advocate for increased funding rather than for a payback of those borrowed funds. Schools should not be put into this defensive position of feeling the necessity to advocate for the continuance of shifts and gimmicks, which has contributed to the downgrading of our state's credit rating by Standard & Poor, Moody's, and Fitch, all major credit rating agencies. The most recent agency to downgrade our credit rating was Standard & Poor's. Standard & Poor's analyst Robin Prunty cited temporary budget fixes, including the delayed school aid payments, as reasons for the downgrade. As we all know, a downgraded credit rating means higher interest costs not only for the state, but all local units of government, including school districts. While discussion of credit ratings may not seem significant in these times of low interest rates, it's important to note that history has shown us that interest rates will not always be low. And we need to consider the future and the future of our children. Mr. Chair, members, I would ask that you consider the consequences of not paying back the shift, of simply, hopefully, relying on continued economic improvement in our state to pay back the shift. We need to protect our schools, get our fiscal house in order, find a way to provide additional much-needed new funding to our schools, and pay back the shift. Our state constitution says that it is the state's responsibility to provide for an adequate educational system for our children. Establishing a stable and predictable payment schedule to our schools is fundamental to meeting that charge. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Representative Seltzer. Any questions for the author of the bill? Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Seltzer, thank you again. I feel like this is a broken record on my part. I really appreciate the fact that DFL caucus has put this as their number one and that you are on House File 1.
Thank you.
So I'm hopeful that rather than laying it over, we could move it faster than that, but of course that's at the discretion of the chair, so I understand where this may be headed. Where do you see the funds coming from to pay back the shift? Because House File 1 really just addresses the aid entitlement, correct, not the property tax recognition. So where do you foresee the money coming from to do that?
Representative Seltzer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, that's an excellent question. And with the February forecast coming, I'm very hopeful that that will take care of it. And as to your question, is why I didn't include the property tax shift. You know, when I was campaigning, I talked about a sensible plan to pay back the shift. We didn't get into this position overnight, and I don't think we'll get out of it overnight, but I think this is an important first step in making that commitment to provide stable and equitable funding to our schools.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a quick follow-up to that. So if the forecast holds, and we've got another $254 million, and as we've discussed, we're not sure what's going to happen there because we haven't seen the expenditures, and you know there's still a little bit to play there. And this piece of the education shift is about $550 million, so we'd still have another $300 million. Where do you think that money would come from?
Well, you know what?
Representative Seltzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Woodard, I look forward to that conversation because that's a difficult conversation that we'll need to have.
Representative Woodard.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Seltzer.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Seltzer, do you know what this has cost our school districts? For example, who had to borrow and what kind of interest did they have to pay? And, you know, what does their future look like? If you could cite a few districts. I don't know if your own is included in this, but if it is, maybe you could use it as an example.
Representative Seltzer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I do know that across our state, in aggregate, school districts have paid between $5 to $10 million. I do not have specific examples for you, though I'm sure I could get those.
And Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Since this has been going on since the 80s, do we have any idea, perhaps Mr. Strom knows, I'm sure Mr. Crow probably would have told us, but and maybe Ms. Johnson knows, in aggregate, what has this cost school districts since we've been doing this borrowing scheme?
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, I believe Ms. Johnson's got a nice chart in the document with the actual dollar amounts, and we'll look for that to make sure. It's either in one of our guidebooks or in this document. So we'll look for that and see if we've got that in the folder.
Okay. Any other questions, Representative Erickson, and then we can come back to that?
Sure.
Also, my intent is to hear House File 134 before we take testimony, because they're fairly identical with the exception of the addition of the property tax recognition shift. So any other questions for Representative Newton?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to respond to Representative Erickson, I give you pretty close to the figures for Anoka-Hennepin, which we have about 5% of the student population in the state. We borrowed roughly $160 million a year. The interest on that is in the neighborhood of $84,000. However, the school district was able to put that money in the bank as they didn't have to pay all of it out right away, and they made roughly that amount in interest. So they pretty well covered the amount that they had borrowed. One of the things, I'm probably, it seems from what I've heard, about the only person who didn't run on paying back the shift. And I would like to explain very briefly why. Representative Quam, you mentioned the $140 million. If we use that to pay back the shift, in my district, instead of paying $84,000 in interest, we'd pay about $75,000. However, if we took that money and take the 5% and pay it to our school district, we'd have $7 million more for our students. So I don't think that the shift should be paid back. And, you know, I know I can see the trend because I think I'm the only one that didn't run on this during the last election. But I just wanted to pass those figures on. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other? Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just, you know, when I was first on the school board and I found out about this shift thing, I thought, well, why are they doing that? And they always hold back a little money because of enrollment fluctuation, too. And, you know, so it's not, you know, there's always been a little bit of a shift. It's just the state saw this this shift and decided, well, we can actually manipulate it for, you know, for our benefit in certain years where we have a shortfall. So, I mean, they've always held back some money, and I see the bills do a 90-10 shift, and that's because we'd usually start out with more students in September than we wound up with in May, and I don't, you know, for various reasons. And so that's why they kept it back, because of enrollment fluctuation, you know, within the school district. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions from the Representative Selzer? Any? Well, we'll come back, I guess, and hear. But if you got any other comments on the bill?
No, I appreciate the opportunity to have this bill heard. I've looked forward to it, and I hope that we work towards paying back the shift and getting our schools back onto stable, predictable funding and find a way to provide our schools with much-needed new money.
Very good. So what we will do now, we'll hear House File 134, and then we'll take public testimony for or against House File 1 and House File 134 at that point. Representative Woodard, if I'll move to move House File 134 for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate, again, Representative Seltzer on House File 1. The difference between House File 1 and House File 134 is very simple, and we discussed it just a minute ago, and that is the property tax recognition chip. What House File 134 does is not only pay back the aid entitlement, but it also pays back the property tax recognition chip. So the total $1.1 billion today that we would owe our schools. And let me talk a little bit about the school shift itself, and then we'll talk about House File 134. You know, we've talked about the cost of the shift, and I appreciate Representative Newton's comments on what it's done for Anoka. But if we don't pay it back now, there's another $151 million. We discussed that last week in committee, that there's an additional $151 million that will be added to the shift if we don't pay it back now, if we continue to push it off to the next biennium. And there, in our packets, I was noticing that Dr. Peterson has written testimony. I assume he can't be here, so he left written testimony. And I found it interesting. He says no one talks about the 90-10 shift. And I'm certainly willing to talk about the 90-10 shift. I think last year we had a bill, Representative Garofalo had a bill that would have taken that to 95-5. And, you know, heck, let's talk about going to 100. So I'm willing to talk about eliminating shifts, period, if we think that's the right move, and it may be a good conversation for us to have. He also mentions that this really isn't a problem, that, you know, the school districts don't really care, that it's not an accounting gimmick or a trick. And I guess I would argue with that. Again, it's hard to argue against a piece of paper, and I wish Dr. Peterson was here, because I think we'd have a very good discussion of that. But if it's not a gimmick and it doesn't distort accounting, then for fiscal year 12-13, under the last time the GOP was in control of the legislature, we actually increased funding for education by 33%. Because if you take the shift out of it, we increased 33%. That seems like a distortion of the reality of what happened, and I don't think anybody in this room, whether you're testifying or whether you're a member of the committee, would think that we actually increased funding in K-12 education by 33%. So the education shift does distort our accounting practices. It does allow me to say, and in all reality, to say we increased funding by 33%, and in contrast, Governor Dayton's plan only increases by 1.9%. So who cares more about education? And we know that's an accounting gimmick. We know it's a tool in the toolbox, if gimmick is something that people kind of shy away from. So it's a tool in the toolbox that does distort our accounting practices. And as far as why I wanted the property tax recognition to be taken care of as well, you know, I've seen a run of different districts and how the property tax shift or property tax recognition shift affects different districts. And it does affect districts differently. Certainly, if you look at Belle Plaine School District, we're showing about a $340 per pupil effect by not dealing with the property tax recognition shift. It goes all the way up to $1,400 for Bloomington. I'm not sure anybody represents Bloomington on the committee. But the Bloomington School District has $1,400 per pupil that this affects. So we ought to take this off of the books now. Let's take care of it so that we can really have the serious and honest and open conversation about what funding looks like for K-12 education in the state of Minnesota. And to me, that's possibly, no, definitely more important than actually the cash flow. The cash flow to the state or the cash flow to the school districts are important, but I think the primary reason is we have to get this off our books so that we can really talk about what education funding looks like and we don't distort the numbers. And Mr. Chair, on the three-fifths majority bills, I'm certainly willing to, if you would like, to talk about those now. They're kind of very similar, or we can wait. I know they're related, but...
Representative Woodard, I would like to wait so that we could take the public testimony on these two and then come back if that would be all right.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Then just a final statement then about House File. This is applicable to House File 1 as well as to House File 134. You know, we talked about this on the floor. If people remember, it was a long time ago that we were on the floor. But we talked about payment of the shift, and I think it's probably going to be one of those things we'll talk about a lot on the House floor. But, you know, we can't rely on the future revenue forecasts that are in the governor's budget that thinks we're actually going to pay this back in 17. And the reason that is because we really don't know what the tax plan is going to end up being, whether $3.8 billion in increased taxes is actually going to pass. We've seen both from my caucus, who doesn't like it at all, and from members of the DFL caucus that don't like portions of it or parts of it, that probably will not be the final tax plan. And even if it is, those revenues are still suspect because we're not sure the effect of taking $3.8 billion out of the economy will really have, or out of the private sector will really have on the economy. So those numbers are a little bit nebulous as well. And to continue to push that on down the road and say, well, we'll just do that, deal with it in the next biennium and waiting to see what our income looks like, I think is irresponsible. And, you know, that's why in a minute we'll talk about the three-fifths majority, because we shouldn't be in this position. We shouldn't be talking today about paying back the shift. Today is good, valuable committee time that we should be talking about the stuff that the chair has talked about, which is, you know, good database research on what works in education. Instead, here we are talking about an accounting shift, an accounting gimmick, an accounting tool in the toolbox that we ought to get off the table. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Representative Woodard. Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Woodard, I'm wondering if you've had the discussion with your local school districts about the relative merits of paying back the shift versus, for instance, funding for special ed or early childhood.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Briner, I don't want to throw any of my school members under the, or school board members or superintendents under the bus here with conversations I've had with them. But I'll tell you generically what they've told me. And it varies between the school board and the superintendents, quite frankly. School boards tend to say, we need to take this off, get this off the books. I mean, those are representatives of our community who get that this is something that distorts the conversation. And they want the conversation to be clean and clear about education financing. I would tell you that a year and a half ago, when we talked about passing the shift, they were adamant this was going to kill them. This was not a good idea. We should not be shifting funds. Today, as you'll hear from possibly testifiers, as we've seen from the platform of AMSD and other education advocates, that they don't really care about the shift, which I find interesting now because in the past they haven't liked the shift. So, you know, it's a varied opinion, as Minnesotans have as well. Although I would say that if I talk to, especially on the campaign trail, talking to average Minnesotans at the door and everywhere else, they don't like this idea. They don't like the shifting idea. And that's why this is important that we take care of this now.
Representative Briner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the range of input you've had, and as similarly I've had, but I would say that you're correct that the average citizen perceives it in a pretty straightforward way, but my experience with both school board members and superintendents is quite different because they understand their ability to manage the shift, especially if the trade-off is new money. If they're just dealing with the shift and not new money, it's a different issue. But I think it's, in my years of experience on a school board and in the legislature, without fail, superintendents and school boards prefer the shift over a cut.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Briner, I don't disagree with you that probably is your experience. But I think it goes beyond just the parochial discussion with education advocates, even whether it's school boards or superintendents or AMSD or whoever it might be, because this is a philosophical issue about whether or not we should be funding future commitments with past obligations. Mm-hmm. That we've got these past obligations. It's like saying, we talked a little bit about where would this money come from. So I'm willing to step out and say, I think at least part of it can come from our budget reserve. Because we're sitting with money in a budget reserve, and it's like saying we've got money in the bank account, and we have this credit card debt over here. We'd rather put it over here in the bank account rather than paying off that debt that's costing us money and causing a distortion in our accounting. So I think it goes beyond just what school districts look at from their cash flow situation, and I'm glad to hear that most school districts had enough money that this wasn't an issue for them. But for some it is. And it affected school districts differently. It depends upon your cash situation. It depends upon your financial situation of the particular school district that we're talking about. But it isn't equitable pain across all school districts. And I think we need to keep that into account as well.
Representative Reinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification, I was in no manner implying that school districts had enough money. Managing the shift is quite a different issue than whether it costs you. It's the relative cost compared to not having funding in other areas, I think, that school districts are evaluating.
Representative Hertoth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of comments of background before I get to my question, but in my world in real estate and development, our industry has always been very interest rate sensitive. And when 9/11 occurred, there was a massive movement of capital out of the equity markets into what was perceived to be the best and safest, most stable investment in America, and that was American real estate. And it created and contributed largely to a bubble which has, you know, become a latent effect of where we are at 10 years later. And the economy and the bubble burst has had a skewed effect on real market rates in terms of interest and interest charges. And even as a management of a city, we've been able to take advantage of refunding bonds and doing refunding payments and see improved interest rates because of an artificially low interest rate. But as we move out of this recession and the demand for capital returns and we're experiencing a significant rate of inflation in terms of the value of our dollar, it's perceived by many that for sure interest rates will dramatically rise. And so we've heard the rhetoric. We had a all-district meeting of superintendents last week, and I heard things consistent with what Representative Newton said about not really having a lot of concern about the shift. But I suspect that this will be quite different when schools have to borrow money at market rates rather than artificially low rates. Do you have any opinion on that in terms of what that would mean, and perhaps maybe Mr. Strom might have some experience historically in the past. In the 80s, we paid rather high interest rates, and this might be a more tenable situation than it is currently today. So, you know, your effort to move legislation to get this property tax shift off the books probably is, in my view, a very responsible thing, but could you comment on that?
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hertoth. It's a great question, and it's a great point, which is why we'll talk a little bit later about the three-fifths majority. Because right now, you're right, some school districts, and they're not all, but maybe even the majority of school districts, don't care about the shift. It's not a big issue for them. They'd rather see, as Representative Reinert had mentioned, additional money onto the formula, additional obligations moving forward, rather than us paying that past obligation. But in the future, that money can be much more expensive. I mean, the economic realities in the next decade are not something any of us here could predict. And so if we continue to use this idea and continue to shift, that can really seriously affect our school districts in the future to the point where it could be very painful. And so this addiction to doing these shifts has to be stopped. So that we, when we are in that environment, that we don't have that issue. And I think that's an excellent point that we need to, you know, consider as we're talking about these bills.
Representative Hertoth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Strom, do you have any recollection of of how much of a burden shifts were in the past when we were in a much higher interest rate market.
Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertaus, yes, the shift has been with us in one form or another for many of the years since 1981. And we've had interest rates quite a bit higher, as you know, than now. For a number of years in the late 80s, when school districts were doing their cash flow borrowing, their rate that they were paying was in the 4 or 5% rate. That rate's been quite low recently for school districts, but part of that is because the school district borrowing is done through a general obligation borrowing that's also guaranteed by the state. So the school districts are really fortunate to have that situation facing them. For other organizations like charter schools, their borrowing often is at a much higher rate. They're often using a line of credit or some funding vehicle like that for their short-term borrowing. And they're often facing an interest rate of 6 or 8% or higher, even in today's low-interest environments. But generally speaking, the school districts are about able to get about the best interest rate possible because of the state guarantee of their bonds.
Thank you.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you.
Very good. I think also now, Representative Erickson, the staff has an answer to your question, so I want to go back to you if we can. Ms. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I totaled the amount of the shift since 1983, going back to 1983, and the amount was approximately $5.8
billion. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Johnson. That's very informative. You know, what's interesting in my years here is that the shift was never an issue until this last campaign. I mean, it was something that school boards talked to me about, especially in the late 80s, as was pointed out by Mr. Strom, you know, that higher interest rate. But it obviously was used as a tool for a long, long time, and school districts accepted it. But then during this campaign, it just became the issue. And so people started buying into that, realizing that perception is, perception becomes reality. And so stealing from the kids or borrowing from the kids, that's what the public heard. And, you know, I feel for school districts, and I appreciate the letter from the superintendent from Minnetonka, because Superintendent Peterson is right on in some of these statements that this is not balancing the state's budget on the backs of school children, because schools do get their money. And that's what I kept saying during my campaign. You will get your funding, but it's going to come later. So, you know, I think we need to end this whole gimmick, as I would call it, and stop, go back to the 90-10, which is what we set out to do, instead of manipulating school funding actually to increase funding in other areas, because that's what I've seen happening during my 14 years.
Thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment about the governor's budget. The you know, one of the things I read, and I like to double-check everything, but it would be interesting to verify, is that the personal income growth for the last several years has been about 2% in the state of Minnesota. But the governor's budget relies on a personal income growth of about 4% based on the information I read. So it's an assumption that doubles the personal income growth in order to create a balanced budget in the future. So I guess just for verification, if research could verify what the personal income growth actually is in the governor's budget. And again, I try to double check anything you read one place, you like to double check it. But I think if that's an underlying assumption, then it puts the projected revenues on a shaky ground, and it's all the more reason that we need to straighten out the educational shift situation.
Representative Grunhagen, good question. And
thank you, Chair. Any other
comments
from
me? As a governor makes a proposal, and you know, I'm sure it's probably off at that time the November forecast. And are they looking at, you know, what the percent of personal income is going to go up? Because that, I would believe, would be in the forecast. And Mr. Strom, how does that calculation? And then, of course, he's got the actual changes in tax law, which also changes revenue amounts. But
yeah, Mr. Chair, members, when the governor puts his budget together, it's built on the assumptions that are included in the two forecasts, the November and the February forecast. The way Minnesota does this, we have an office in the Department of Management in Budget that works on the forecast, and they consult, they put together the state forecast of revenues and expenditures, and that's built heavily on their consultant that they use, the consulting firm that provides them with the underlying economic data for the nation. I think we use Global Insight currently for that. So the forecast growth rates that are there are from a range of scenarios that are presented through Global Insight, and then I believe the way that process works as to which scenario is chosen is done by the Governor's Council of Economic Advisors, so that the growth rates that are picked are something where the state has a series of options, but those are picked by the professional staff in that office and then are incorporated in the forecast. And then when the governor makes his budget proposal on top of that, the forecast that's in place for baseline or current law is what that goes on top of.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, you know, it'd be interesting, and again, I'd like those figures actually confirmed, but it'd be interesting for the committee to look at if the assumption is, and I'd like that verified, 4% in the governor's budget, versus what it actually has been, which is a little right around 2%. It'd be interesting for the committee to see the different projections on the budget by changing the assumption in personal income, since income tax is a major part of our total revenues here in the state. The other thing is, I tend to lean towards the 2% personally, just because I've been trying to hold my wife's spending down lately. Just kidding. Honey, we're only going to grow at 2% here. Can't spend 3% of our income. No, she's very frugal, by the way. She's not here to defend herself. And if she hears me say that, I'll get a phone call in a little bit.
Be sure we get that in the record.
Yeah. The reason I lean towards the 2% is because of our state demographer, Tom Gillespie, with the retiring baby boomers, which if you read any of his reports or see his presentation, we're going to expect much lower growth in economically in the state. Well, it's across the nation because of the demographic change of the movement of the baby boomers from being the productive engine of the economy to now drawing on the economic assets of the economy, and that's going to have huge cultural changes and economic changes in our society going forward. We all know health care, if we don't get it under control, is going to eat up all additional revenues in the future. Again, this is based on Tom Gillespie's projections. So I think it's imperative that we as a committee look at different scenarios and not just a rosy one, which I consider 4% to be pretty rosy. And my wife always says, you always put rose-colored glasses on everything. but also to look at the possibility that income would grow at a slower rate. And we all know when you go from 4 to 2%, that's going to have huge implications in terms of budget surplus or shortfalls as we go forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. I know, you know, I mean, that's very important. That's why we have the forecast in the state, so we get some idea of economic forecast and what type of revenues are going to come in, since a large bulk of our revenues are income and sales taxes dependent on the economy. I'm going to ask Mr. Strom this question. I think in every forecast there's also towards the back a document called the price of government. And one of the very last lines, usually it's a two-page sheet, has personal income. And like I think I was just looking at that because Representative Morgan had asked a few weeks ago, when we were looking at the price of government as to what we were paying in education. And at one time it was like 5.02%, and now it was 4.02%. So the question was, what is that 1% equal to? And I think it's something, overall, it's like $260 billion is our total income, personal income. So 1% would be $2.5 billion, something like that. But so could we see that number? I mean, if Representative Gruenhagen wanted to look, could he go to that? Is that where that's at in the forecast, that price of government document?
Mr. Chair, I had just sent a note upstairs to have them send the 12 pages of the description of the economic forecast down to us, and I'll send up a note for the price of government, which is a four-page report, and they can see that.
Mr. Strom and staff, they're always one step ahead. Always. Thank you very much. Thanks for those questions, Representative Gruenhagen. Representative Breinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we're talking about the shift in the historical record, I'd just like staff to clarify, given that we've been using the shift for a number of years, what about the history of the percentage on the shift? Historically, what has been the percentage?
Ms. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Breinert, I have a document here that shows the percentage of aid payment shift going back to the 1982. Throughout the 80s, it was about 85% from 1983 to 1997, actually. In 1998, it went back up to 90%. 2003 went down to 83%. 2005 to 84.3%. And then it got paid back in 2006 to 90%. And then the most recent history that you're aware of. So I can provide a copy of this as well for everyone.
Representative Breinert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My point was that the 60-40 shift is the largest we've ever had, and that was some of the reason, I think, for the level of attention that the issue drew.
Representative Woodard, would you like to weigh in a little bit?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to weigh in on that one. That could take a while. Fortunately, it was 60-40. It could have been 50-50. There was a proposal to make it a 50-50 shift, and that ended up being a 60-40. We had bills that would have paid that back, would have taken it to 85-15. There was all kinds of conversations and bills being passed that would have adjusted that 60-40. And the end result is that it was paid back using existing revenue, using the surplus revenue that occurred over the last 2 years, so that if you look at it on a biennium basis, it wasn't a 60-40 shift. That money was paid back pretty rapidly to the point we're at now, which is 82.5, 17.5. And I can tell Representative Breinert doesn't like that answer. So.
Representative Breinert.
Mr. Chair, no, it's not a matter of liking it or not. My point was only for the historical record. The number is significant, and that is part of what led to the discussion. Whatever movements there were around paying it back, or however you evaluate the mechanism through which the shift has diminished, the fact is 60-40 was the largest historical shift on record.
Okay. Any other questions from? So I'm going to ask Representative Seltzer if you would join Representative Woodard. And Representative Woodard, would you grab another chair so that both of you can be up there, and then when the testifiers come up, they thank you so much. And as mentioned previously, we do have some written testimony that should be in your packet. So you can look at that. And so we can put the testifiers in the middle as they come between the authors of the bill. They'll put a little more pressure on. So is there anyone who would like to testify in the audience from the public for or against House File Number 1 or House File Number 134? Please proceed. And if you would please state your name for the record, and good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Scott Kronquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and thank you for the opportunity to offer some comments. Being handed out is a letter. We're trying to save you, I think, a little testifying time this morning, so a number of individuals have signed the letter, and just for the record, the signatories on that are Gary Amoroso, Minnesota Association of School Administrators, Brad Lundell, Schools for Equity, Fred Nolan, Minnesota Rural Education Association, Mike Berlager with the Minnesota Association of School Business Officials, Jim Grathwell from Minneapolis Public Schools, Mary Doherty Gilbert from St. Paul Public Schools, and myself. First of all, Mr. Chairman and members, we want to thank Representative Seltzer and Representative Woodard for bringing the legislation forward and drawing attention to the issue and for the commitment to repaying the SHIFT eventually. And I would put a stress on the word eventually, though. We don't think the SHIFT needs to be, repayment needs to be accelerated. We think that the current law has been working very well, and you need to look no further back than the November forecast when, as you all know, $1.3 billion was repaid, bringing us back up to a current level of 82.5%, I think. As you all know, we started at 60% in 2011. So the current law is working. It's moving money towards repaying the SHIFT. And the reality is that right now we have higher priorities. In fact, we have many higher priorities, and that it's not a close call. They're much higher priorities. Number one might be ensuring that we move the basic formula allowance up at least by inflation. And I would say at least by inflation, because that would not then even address the fact that we've lost ground to inflation over the last 10 years. We really need to actually try to restore some of that lost purchasing power. We are in a climate where we have an over $600 million special education cross-subsidy. So school districts, you know, on average are taking $600 off their formula allowance that's meant for general instruction and instead having to spend that on special education. We are in a situation where we are way behind the rest of the country in terms of full-day kindergarten. Minnesota ranks near the bottom in the number of students that are in full-day K. We think you need to make that a higher priority. Technology, one other example, again, way behind. We are nowhere near providing the technology that our students need to be successful. So those are just a few items that we would list as much higher priorities than repaying the SHIFT. I'm not going to get into all the nitty-gritty details or the interest charges, but we do think that it's a tool, in fact, that can be used if it's used responsibly and sparingly to try to avoid cuts to school districts. But now that we're in the situation we're in, school districts have largely adapted to the new payment schedule. The cash flow issues are not nearly what they were in the first year of the SHIFT. School districts are, by and large, are now on that new schedule and are making do. And so now we're asking you to put your attention on other priorities. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Brad Lundell with Schools for Equity and Education. I'm up here with Mr. Kroonquist today to talk about our hope that you take a balanced approach to paying back the SHIFT and, as Mr. Kroonquist said, putting more resources into education. We have written testimony that was provided as well as part of our addendum to our equity and adequacy platform. I think what Mr. Kroonquist has talked about, the needs that are there, the resource needs for school districts, we've had countless studies over the last decade and a half that show how Minnesota is lagging in terms of resources going into education. We think that that is the number one priority as you move forward. I think that using a bad analogy here, I guess the point gets to be the SHIFT is cutting off toes. Not putting money into education and the resource base is amputating the leg. Now, I think Representative Herzog has made a very good point. As interest rates go up, they're going to be taking a few more toes. But the point is we'll be limping, but we'll still be able to walk. The thing is that we're just not funded to the level we need to be, and paying back the SHIFT would take half $1 billion off the table. The money that could go to resources to some of the things that Mr. Kroonquist has pointed out. I understand the sentiments behind the bill, though. Stability is important, and I think one of the issues here, more than stability, though, is transparency. There's a difficulty in, and we've seen this, I think, in all financial elements throughout throughout the financial world, the difficulty of describing what happens in finance to the person on the street. And I think that transparency issue is the issue that really clouds things here. Stability, I think, again, we don't know what long-term interest rates are going to be. Stability is needed, though, but there's, again, those two stabilities, the stability of resources and the stability of cash flow. And those are two entirely different elements. And I think the resource level is the level that we are most interested in maintaining right now. We see that there's another $140 million that's coming in above projections for the with tax collections for the next forecast. Some are concerned it's one-time money. Well, this is one-time money, too. So it's a good way to match this up. We'll get back to 85-15 probably, which it was prior to the mid-90s. I think the other question here, and I want to put this in, is not directly related to this, but I still think that this is another way where the state takeover of the general education levy is just a gift that keeps on giving. Because when the state took over the general education levy, they took $1 billion off of property taxes, put $1 billion into state aid that required them, the state, to pay 90-10 on that additional $1 billion. Just has made the situation that much more complicated and that much more untenable, if you will, for the state to keep up with paying this new $1 billion of responsibility on the 90-10. It's another burden that's going to be there, and I think taking the shift or the ability to shift away is going to make that more complicated and more difficult. So, again, we think that this is a tool that can be used. We certainly appreciate the authors coming forward, but we think a more balanced approach is warranted.
We have a couple questions. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having been on this committee the two previous years and hearing the change and how people are speaking about these different topics, my constituents and I grew up in the area are used to listening to what people say and giving credence, and that when people change, do a 180 on how they're talking about a topic, they tend to lose a lot of credibility from where I come from. And, frankly, when you're talking about transparency, any gimmick, I think, decreases transparency. We're being lobbied to not tie the hands and not allow this tool or as, quoting the executive branch gimmick into... don't stop allowing us to do this. Well, that's saying don't stop being less transparent. Don't take away our ability to wordsmith and play games with what's being done here. And, I might be, naive in thinking that we ought to just sit down and speak straight and honest and not gimmicks, not games, and not, it's advantageous for us now to be for something when we spoke vehemently against it. This is why, part of the symptoms of why we have so much of a difficult problem fixing the schools for our kids. Let us get rid of this wordsmithing and gaming, and let us get down to the business of making sure we do the best job for our students in school now and in the future. And I really, really wish that I can take everybody at their word, when they're out in front of the cameras speaking, or they're sending letters, or sitting here talking to us. And so I would ask the testifiers, how does leaving this in the so-called toolbox improve stability and transparency and not obfuscate what we really need to do is straighten this out and improve the schools and do what the children and the parents in this state want us to do?
Mr. Kroonquist or Mr. Lundell?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, committee members, and Representative Quam. First of all, let me say that back in 2011 and many times in previous years before that, when asked our association, and I think most superintendents and school board members have consistently said that if the choice is between a cut and a shift, we'll take the shift. Just no question. I mean, that's simple reality. We've always held that position. Shift's not ideal, but certainly better than a cut. No, just no doubt about that. And conversely, now when we're in the situation we are, same way. New money is preferable to paying back the shift. Now, I would agree with you that, you know, yeah, it would be ideal to get back to the 90-10 and to not have to do it again. And I would agree with the comment Representative Woodard made about maybe the most negative impact of the shift has nothing to do with the financial impact, but it is the public relations problem that it causes. And it really causes problem for local school boards as well as you as legislators. I bet if you talk to a lot of the folks in your community right now, a lot of them are under the impression that schools just got a whole lot of money, right, last November after that forecast. The headline in the paper was, schools get $1.3 billion repaid. Most people don't understand that that was not one penny of new money. And so now they're wondering why they're not getting programs restored and staff hired and computers bought. And so I agree with you that, yeah, that it is a public relations nightmare. But from a financial standpoint, it does allow you to protect education sometimes when times are tough.
Mr. Lundell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, echoing what Mr. Kroonquist said, and I brought the transparency issue into the discussion. The problem here is transparency. The lack of transparency and the lack of ability to explain to the general public that, as Mr. Kroonquist said, now this new $1.3 billion or whatever isn't going to be in the February forecast. Districts are going to be getting the average district is probably going to get a penny on that dollar simply because, you know, those that have borrowed are borrowing at extremely low rates right now. Again, 5 years from now, as Representative Hertaus has pointed out, it could be a nickel, it could be 10 cents, who knows. But the point is that there's just this real disconnect. And we want to work together to make sure that we get to a point where this is cleared up and that we're looking at school districts, looking at what they need, funding them for what they need. But again, this is, put it this way, the shift has basically been given to us on a bipartisan basis over the last 3 decades. And it was given to us. And when we get up, we say, as Mr. Kuhnquist has said, thanks for leaving the other arm, I guess. But the thing is that this is given to us, and we don't get up. We're never really asked on the shift whether we love the shift or whether we hate the shift. Because the answer is obvious. If you go at our base, if you go at our entitlement base, that is what needs to be protected and needs to go forward. How we get that money and the schedule on which we get that money is an entirely different question. Going to vary from district to district. It varies less now than it did in the 1980s when many, many districts, I mean, a lot of districts back then, some of the property wealthy districts had referenda and they got very little state aid, so the 85-15 made very little difference to them. Other districts are getting 100% state aid, the 85-15, the change from 90-10 to 85-15 made a much bigger difference. Now we have more districts. Almost every district is getting a far greater share of state aid, so districts are treated in a more uniform manner. That's because of the general ed levy being taken away, but which has caused another problem, which I pointed out. But again, that issue is one that I think in the general public is extremely hard to get across, because as I've been working on a two-sentence issue for years on the equity issue, and I, you know, to get people through the first sentence is often very difficult. Gets a little bit complex. Now you talk, again, the headlines say money going to schools. Schools aren't really getting any money out of the deal. It's just that the payment shift is being done more rapidly, or being removed more rapidly. So I sympathize with you. We face the same thing, but unfortunately we have a board of directors that vote for us, and you have to go to a general public and have them vote for you, and it becomes very difficult.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to thank the testifiers for coming before us to just bring some words of wisdom and insight into the impact of paying back the school shifts. I'm one to really believe that, you know, those who are being impacted should be educating us on that impact. I've heard it stated here that, you know, paying back the shift now needs to be done to improve the schools now. But what I'm hearing from you is that, you know, that is not so, because schools are hurting. Schools need resources. I remember the first committee hearing, being here and hearing everyone talk about the importance of having a great educational system where all our kids are, you know, performing and graduating on time and closing the achievement gap. And that doesn't happen just because we're going to pay back a school shift. Well, you know, it happens when we have the resources and the tools to do what we need to do to educate our kids. We talked about, you know, the impact of the shift and not being able to invest in our special education. You know, we talk about anti-bullying and, you know, and the need to have that. Well, that's not free. That costs. It's a cost to that. We talked about teacher evaluations and the importance of having effective teachers in front of our classrooms and to be able to evaluate them. That is not free. That costs money. And schools are trying to find the challenges of how do they do all that and then ensure that they are doing all they can to just ensure that our kids are getting what they need to in order to be successful in school. So, you know, many of us ran on this premise that, you know, we need to pay back the school shift. You know, I was one of them and talked about the importance of that because, you know, we should never be borrowing from our school. You know, that's a fact. But, you know, when we come before those who are impacted, we have school districts here just saying, you know, this is the impact of paying it back, and it doesn't invest any more money. We need the money. I think it is uncommon on us that when we want to do better and someone has given an opportunity to do better, we need to do that. You know, minds change when you become more informed, when you learn about impacts. Your mind should change if it's for the betterment of what we say we want to do to ensure that we're doing the best for schools statewide, for kids statewide. And for me, you know, as we look at whether or not we're going to pay back the school shifts or not, and I think we will. I think we all want to do that. But do we need to do it right now at this moment? What is the impact of doing it right now on our schools? And I think you guys have painted a clear picture. You know, so it's not uncommon for me to, with my big ideas, to say, oh, I need to stay at the path of what I said to an election year, because so much like my not understanding the outcome, the impact of that, many of the public do not understand that. There are many parents who do not understand that. There are many of our constituents who do not understand the impact of what that means to pay back the shift now when we want a quality education system now. So I just want to thank you for just helping us to better understand the impact of paying back that shift now.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lindell, you made a comment earlier, I see it written in the top paragraph of the back page of the handout you distributed. From 1983 to 1996, state law required a school payment schedule of 85-15. Since 1997, the state has had a 90-10 payment schedule, but obviously not really.
Right.
So, first question I have for you, Mr. Lindell. What precisely was it that made state law go from the 85-15 to the 90-10 payment schedule?
Mr. Lindell?
Do you know?
Mr. Trom can help me out in here, but it was former Representative Bob Ness who represented a lot of low property well school districts that got most of their money in terms of state aid and very little in terms of referendum, wanted to improve the cash flow for districts that were predominantly state aid. Again, this was pre-takeover of the general education levy, so there was a kind of a disadvantage for districts that were getting primarily aid at 85-15 as opposed to 90-10. Again, it sped up cash flow, but it didn't put anything in entitlements. But I can find former Representative Ness for you. I run into him periodically, and he can go into it further. But prior to the takeover of the general education levy, a number of districts were 75% levy of what they collected, and other districts were 75% aid in their total revenue. And so there was a difference then that cash flow made more of a difference for the low property wealth districts, and Representative Ness made that adjustment.
Representative
proposed Morgan. That adjustment. And
thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lindell, then, things have changed. A lot of things have changed since 1997. Maybe, perhaps, it's time to take a look at going back to the old payment schedule. It worked for so long. Have things changed to the degree that maybe an 85-15 is a better payment schedule? What do you think about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Morgan, at the risk of having people meet me in the hallway with torches and pitchforks, I would say that it's something to look at. I wouldn't advocate it one way or the other. I think that, again, the general education takeover, as that was taken in place, I don't think that was ever thought of what this new $1 billion of state responsibility, what was that going to mean to the payment schedule. Now, obviously, from the general education takeover to now, we've been at 90-10, I think, 1 or 2 years. And so it's the 85-15, whatever the case might be. Again, I'm not going to advocate it. I think it's something worthy of study. As what Representative Hertaus says, we don't know what long-term interest rates are going to look like. But again, if you want to get to a place where there's stability and transparency, I think that this is probably needs to be on the table of the things. But again, I'm not advocating moving in that direction. Make that clear. Is this on camera? I want to make sure I'm not advocating that.
Thank you, Mr. Lindell. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Well, Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just to the testifiers, I appreciate your comments in terms of the effect inflation has had on school funding, but just a balancing comment that's had the same effect on taxpayers' income. We had a chart here, and I was looking for it in my packet, but I just couldn't locate it, that showed from 2002 to 2012, even though funding had gone up in a particular education program, the actual purchasing power of those dollars had decreased by about 30%, which pretty much lines up with what economic forecasters tell us in the business magazines, that the dollars depreciated in the last 10 years about 30% in terms of purchasing power. So even though the funding was higher in this particular education program, the purchasing power of that dollar had dropped below the 2002 funding level. And I can appreciate the stress that puts on on our government institutions. But we also have to remember that the average family out there has experienced that same decrease. And their income, the majority of them, has not gone up 30%, okay, over the last 10 years. So to constantly go back to those people and ask for more when they're having a hard time paying their electric bill and their fuel bill and buying the groceries, which tend to all go up exponentially on them also, besides health care, I think, we really need to look at the money we're spending and if we're doing it effectively and efficiently within education and getting the most benefit for every dollar spent. And I'll just go back to, the example that I mentioned earlier. And I was a school board member for 16 years. Did I mention that earlier? How many know I was at now? There's one. Now I lost my train of thought with my own humor. That's what I get. So the point is that, my example that I gave earlier was when we couldn't get an excess operating levy passed in our school district and we were had declining enrollment and statutory operating debt, we looked at the structure of how we delivered education. We examined the 4-period day, the 7-period day, and the 6-period day. And we just by changing that structure alone, we saved $300,000 a year, and we kept a strong academic and athletic program. and then we made a number of other changes. But the point is, I think before we go to the public who's also experiencing this 30% decrease in purchasing power, which, by the way, is why our federal government, and this is bipartisan, it's been done under Republicans and Democrats, are perverting our monetary system, and ultimately it makes all of our lives miserable. We need to make sure that what we're doing is as effective and efficient as possible, so that because those people are squeezing every dollar out there also. So don't you think in retrospect and looking forward with the demographic changes that are coming in our country, that we in education and in government in general have to start looking at every program and squeezing every dollar before we turn to tax increases? Appreciate your comments on that.
That might be an answer that could take a while. That was a pretty broad question. We've got other testifiers, and I know Representative Woodard. Representative Woodard, go ahead, and then we'll come back. Just hold up just a second,
Mr. Chairman. I'll just put the question out there for food for thought
that's
for all of us.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Mr. Lundell.
Representative Grunhagen, I haven't had a chance to meet with you yet this session. I think that we'll discuss this topic in greater detail when I sit down with you.
I look forward to discussing. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, testifiers. And then, Representative Woodard, you have a comment. And if there's other testifiers, if you would come down at this time, please.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I just had a question for the testifiers.
I'm sorry.
Lundell, I'm sure we'll...
Go ahead, Representative Woodard.
You can always, if he would like to comment, he certainly can. Just real quickly, you know, we're looking at a $3.8 billion tax increase the governor's proposed. Out of that, he actually allocates about 9%, so $334 million in spending for K-12 education. There's still a lot of work to be done. You guys understand probably better than anybody here that that's going to be very complex. If at the end of the day, we have to look at, or the legislature needs to look at, a shift. So we're talking about, Representative Seltzer and I would like to pay back the shift. There's going to be pressure in the next 4 months to actually extend the shift, not just extend it as it is today, but to increase the shift. So what's the tolerance level on the part of the folks that you represent for an increased shift? Knowing that these interest rates are so low, it sounds like it's really not causing any issues. Representative Newton brought that up as well. So what is the tolerance level? Can we get to a, you know, we don't want to get to a, and Representative Brainerd, this is in jest for you, to the Governor Dayton 60-40 shift. Wow. We know it was all of us, but Governor Dayton has also signed it, so this is a bipartisan historic shift. So what is the threshold there for an additional shift?
On the pain chart, from a very sad face to a very happy face, where are we at with the threshold there, Mr. Kroonquist?
Mr. Chairman and members, you know, we haven't really had that discussion this year in my legislative committee, but I know a number of superintendents have publicly said they would prefer that you not, if the next forecast, for instance, shows there's additional revenue, they would say they would have a much higher preference that you take that money and invest it in education rather than continue to pay back the SHIP. And I would guess that there'd be pretty broad agreement among school officials with that sentiment.
Mr. Lundell, in about 10 seconds, you're...
Yeah, Representative Marquardt, or Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Woodard, I would say I echo Mr. Kroonquist. We haven't polled anyone. I think, again, we have what Representative Hertaus has talked about with what long-term interest rates are going to be like, that would be the thing that I think we'd have to keep in mind as well. But I think that there is tolerance there for... said, you know, reasonableness.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No follow-up questions, but just some advice that you might want to go back and poll.
Good job.
And if you would please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, channel.
Good job.
And if you would please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswager, Education, Minnesota. I'm going to take a little bit different approach. Excuse me. I'd like you to think about what we're doing here today. Are we treating the symptoms or the cause? And really, what we think what we're doing is trying to fix the symptoms here. You think back in the late 90s, there was a series of income tax cuts that were significant. Excuse me. And in 2001, there was some education reform proposed by Governor Ventura. And with that reform, a $900 million tax increase was proposed. It never went into law. As a result of some of these activities, we are now in a place where we've had, you know, $5 billion deficits. Also, we have the economy issues as well. And sometimes we have difficult times, and we have to adjust for those. But overall, Education Minnesota believes that a shift should not be used to balance the budget, only in extreme cases. It's not a never, but it's something that we don't like. When it comes to providing class money for class size or at least having adequate instruction, that's important, and they're tough choices. There are times when it probably does have to be done. But we're not here today to say that you can do it any time. We'd like long discussions. But paying back the shift in its entirety creates a stress on the entire state budget. It's not just education. It's health and human services. It's public safety. It's every piece of the budget, because tough decisions are made for the overall budget. This is only one-time money. So when districts get this money, they can't use it to predict in their future budgeting for keeping the class size low for 2, 3, 4 years or any ongoing expenses. And the needs of our students, parents, and the expectations of our parents, the expectations of businesses do not go away. I've heard the discussion about, would you rather have cuts or a shift? I think we need to look bigger than that. We're a sophisticated state. When our students have needs, when we have expectations about what should be provided in education, we should be asking ourselves, should it be cut? Should it be a shift? Should there be a trigger tax to help us when there are tough economic times? Should there be a permanent tax? I'm not here to say what is the right answer. But I think the ultimate solution to this problem is to examine the tax system and reform it so that we are not in this situation and that we can meet the constitutional requirement to educate our kids. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And so we can get to the other bills on the agenda, we've got a question. Representative Hertas, so we'll take one. Oh, this for Ms. Allswiger?
Yes.
Okay. Ms. Allswiger, if you would remain up here. Are there any other testifiers that will be coming forward? Okay. So we'll take one question. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned inferred that income tax cuts or tax cuts during the Ventura years have led to a problem to where we are for the last 5 years, that we've had massive deficits. And you kind of touched my heart and soul with that, because about 20% of the general fund levy revenues are contingent upon construction-related activities. And that's an industry that is terribly hurting right now. And I would suggest that the reason we've had $5 billion deficits is that 20% of the general fund levy. So as far as some of the things in terms of policy, I think we're all here to help solve what the issues are in terms of unfunded mandates like special education and some of the other issues that, the cross-subsidy payments. And I think most people understand and acknowledge that through inflation, your spending power has gone down and certainly is making funding education difficult. But being market-driven, we really need to get Minnesota to work. And we've got one-fifth of our economic engine isn't working right now. We're running the motor on about 5 cylinders instead of 8. And if we can also address that, I think you'll see the revenue coming into our treasury that will allow us to do those things. Unfortunately, when things turn down, it's not easy to turn it around quickly. The private sector has been suffering. And the whole notion of raising taxes at a time in which people have lost spending power is a really tenuous issue, and it's difficult to talk about.
So, thank you. At this time, Representative Selzer, if you have some final comments, and then Representative Woodard. Representative Selzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I really appreciated all the testimony that we heard today. And as a former school board member myself, I did exactly what the testifiers did today, and that is I came and I lobbied parents, and we came and we lobbied not to pay back the shift. We lobbied for more money for schools to help our kids right now, and I understand that completely. But we are state representatives, and we have a different charge, a larger charge, where we need to look at our whole state. We need to look at things that are not exciting, but our credit rating and the cost of doing business in our state. And we need to fix this, because we have had, as has been brought forward, we've just been a roller coaster. We've gone up and down. We have we've had different organizations come to us and say, please don't shift. But then when they're faced with the prospect of not getting new monies that they need, either facing a large cut or a shift, of course they ask for a shift. And then, in the face of the needs that they are facing, with an ever-increasing achievement gap, with an ever-increasing student population, of course they come and say, we need new money. And what I'm saying is that we need to do both, that we do need to pay back the shift, and we do need to find new money to address these issues. And today, the part that I'm talking to you about is taking a huge first step toward that and paying back the delayed payment part of the shift.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and a huge collective bipartisan hug here. This is good. I don't think you see in many committees Representative Seltzer and Representative Woodard sitting together advocating for the exact same thing. So I think, again, that's good in the tradition of the K-12 Education Finance Committee. And at the risk of showing up on a reelect Chair Marquardt campaign somewhere, I would like to thank you for allowing us to have this conversation and for this to be one of our goals. It's not as easy as we probably thought it was even 4 months ago, that we would have this conversation and everyone would get up and say hi and we'd move on. So I appreciate your willingness to continue to go down this route, and I appreciate that. I think Representative Seltzer did a great job describing the situation, and I commend her for that. I would just take it one step further, and House File 134 doesn't just take a step, it actually takes care of the entire shift, and I would highly recommend that we take that additional step to take care of the entire shift. And again, appreciate Representative Seltzer and House File 1 and the commitment to that on the DFL caucus. Hopefully we can get a Senate, as far as I know, there isn't a Senate companion yet. Hopefully we can do that. There isn't for House File 134 yet either, although we're working for that as well. So hopefully the Senate will see the error in their ways as well.
Representative Seltzer, Representative Woodard, thank you so much for bringing forth this discussion today and for very effectively telling how it affects schools and students and why we need to pay back the shift. So thank you so much. And with that, I'll lay over House File number 1 and House File number 134 for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. So thank you. At this time, Representative Woodard, I'll move, or would you like to move House File 53 and House File 235? Yeah. Laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move House File 53 and House File 235 to be placed on the general. I'm sorry to be laid over. Sorry, I missed your instructions there.
Very good, Representative Woodard.
In a future omnibus bill. We've had a very good, strong discussion, again, on the House floor and here in committee about the shift and the impact of the shift. So I'm hoping that even with some of the arguments that paying back the shift should not be a priority, that at least we can all agree on this, that it should be more difficult to ever do this in the future. And I think we've heard that from testifiers today as well. I don't want to put words in their mouths, but certainly they've talked about the fact that they're not big fans of the shift either. It's not like they want to come to the legislature and say, here's an idea, let's shift. So to be able to, in the future, to make this more difficult, and it's a very simple concept that our forefathers put in the state constitution, that it would require a three-fifths majority of the body of the Minnesota House of Representatives and the Minnesota Senate to ever pass a bonding bill, to ever borrow money on behalf of the taxpayers of Minnesota. Makes sense. Should be bipartisan. Should require that level of scrutiny on our part as good fiscal stewards of the taxpayer dollar. They never envisioned that we would actually have a budget that said we're going to owe you later. That said that we're going to balance the budget by saying we owe you this money, we'll just pay it later down the road. And you can borrow money against that future promise. I mean, that's just something they never considered. So this takes care of that and says that if we're going to do that, if we're going to require that to bond, to borrow money, then we ought to do it whenever we do that on a school shift. And all it says is that it takes a three-fifths majority. House File 53 makes it a little bit easier for you because it just says that it's the school aid payment, that it's the entitlement aid. 235 is really where we should be, which is including the property tax recognition and saying either one of those would require a three-fifths majority. And I think it's something that we really can all get behind on a bipartisan fashion and say, yeah, let's make this equivalent to any time we borrow money in other areas of the government. So, Mr. Chair, on that, that's my argument, and I'm sticking to it.
Very good, Representative Woodard. Any questions for Representative Woodard? Any testimony for or against House File 53 or House File 235? If not, Representative Woodard, we will lay over House File 53 and House File 235 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you so much. If the page would pass out, what all the members are getting right now is the price of government report. And Representative Grunhagen had brought this forward. And just more specific to Representative Grunhagen's question, if you would go to this one right here where it says price of government, and then the very back sheet is actually kind of the second page of all the data, and then go to the second to last line where it says Minnesota personal income. If you notice, we're in fiscal year 2014 and fiscal year 2015. You're just looking at some numbers. You've got roughly $248 billion to $256 billion, and that, in my quick math, was a little over 3% growth. And then in the next year, from 256 to 268, that's $12 billion over 256, it's maybe roughly 4.5%. So, Representative Grunhagen, what you mentioned there is that the projections here show about a 3 and a 4% increase the next 2 years on personal income, so how that all factors into things. Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Chair. Yeah, appreciate this information. And I just think it's prudent for us to look at, especially with the demographic changes that our state demographer has said, to look at maybe one or two scenarios. In other words, let's assume this is a optimistic projection when we're looking at, you know, 3 to 4%. What would the budget look like if we had just a 2% growth in personal income? How much would that affect the numbers in the out years as far as our projection? And I just think that, you know, when we look at our federal government and the amount of deficits they're projecting in the entitlement programs, when we look at our shortfalls in our public pension plans across this nation and even in our state, that it behooves us to take a conservative approach to creating additional spending in the future that is based on some realistic assumptions of economic growth based on those factors, and especially the demographic changes. And I think when you start pushing 4% on the assumption of higher personal income taxes, that's getting pretty optimistic in terms of what you hope to see as revenues down the. So I just throw that out for people to think about.
Very good. Members, next Tuesday night, there is going to be a meeting of the joint meeting of the finance committees and public and policy committees. And it's going to be from 6 to 9, and we'll get agendas out tomorrow. But the focus of the meeting is going to be creating the world's best workforce. So we'll have a number of folks and basically looking at what would that workforce look like, where are we at now, what would we need to do to get to the world's best workforce, and what would be some strategies to do that. So we're going to have a number of folks in, and I think it's going to be a very interesting night, and it's kind of with an education focus on it, and looking at what we can do in this committee to actually get us to the world's best workforce. And so as you kind of look ahead in the schedule, that will be, we will meet in the morning on next Tuesday the 19th, then we will meet at night, and then there will be no meeting the next Wednesday morning. So just so you can kind of, if you could plan for that.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunhagen.
We pass a resolution that night meeting doesn't go past 12 o'clock.
I am hoping, Representative Grunhagen, we will not get past that point. I appreciate everyone's enthusiasm today after a late night, and with that, we are adjourned.